shucking jive.
All you racing fans, stand up, clap your feet. I mean, clap your heads.
Welcome to the Goat Rodeo.
CRN Studios in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. This is Racing Through History.
Race fans, welcome to this edition of the Goat Rodeo. I'm Jeff Gilder. I'm the host, and nobody really knows why. We've asked, we've asked for opinions from a lot of people, but we just can't seem to get a good reason that I'm the host. But
that's because you control the buttons.
Because I have the buttons. That's what most people say. I'm not sure if that's the truth, but we'll go with that. So let's get around and say hello to everybody. And all those people that are not privileged to be the host, like me. So, ladies and gentlemen, let's say hello to the underlings. With that in mind, let's start with you.
Underling number one.
And if you're watching the video, which you can't until I post it.
That's right. Facebook, I knew you wasn't up yet. That's why I did that.
He was flipping me the bird.
I gave him the one-finger salute. I'm doing just fine. The weather is warming slightly, the sun is shining, and daylight savings time has given us a daylight ride down here to the studio, so I'm good.
It's going to be colder than crap Wednesday night.
What you mean by warming?
Yeah. Well, it was cold and rainy this morning.
Well, I tell you what, I saw pictures of people with snow heaped up over their cars, and my comment to them was, because they always say they'll take that over the pollen. We've never yet had to shovel the pollen down here, which is a good thing.
Hey, but we're close.
We've almost had two in Columbia.
Did you see Bobby's post of the blizzard in Shallot?
Yes, I did. Yeah. Yeah, I sure did.
He got that much more than I did at Ocean Isle.
Let's talk to Bobby. Is that true, Bobby?
Yeah, it was a blizzard.
Did you go raid the grocery store? Yes.
Well, that was impossible. There wasn't a loaf of bread left in 40 miles or a gallon of milk.
Or a six-pack of beer.
Yep, I saw somebody post there's a blizzard warning. Southerners, stay off the road. Northerners, wear a heavy coat.
I'm not going to say it. I'm going to be nice tonight.
And all the way, ladies and gentlemen, from Hand, South Carolina, the mayor of Hand is here. Coastal Jack Walker, how you doing tonight, CJ?
I'm doing great, man.
Good to see you, man.
Ready for another show.
Yeah, I finally have the video back up now, so all you folks that are on the Racers Reunion site can watch as well as listen. It takes me a few minutes to push all these buttons and make all that happen.
And people, even better than watching this, get on chat. Be sure to sign in so you can see what Hugh's saying on there.
Yeah, he's all time saying
smart-fingered
old guy. Yeah. He's always got some kind of mess going on, as Bobby calls it. So you all right, Bobby?
Good? I'm good.
You're good? All right. All right, cool. Let's go over to our out of the office connection and say hello to Cody Densmore, who's joined us all the way from Dawsonville, Georgia. Mr. Densmore, it's awful good to have you tonight, sir.
It's awful good to be here.
It's good, man. It's good. Good. How's everything in Dawson, Vegas?
It's cold.
Yeah, I heard that.
It is torrential cold, if that's even a word. It's if it's below about 55 degrees, it's too cold for me.
I'm with you, brother.
70.
I'm with you, brother.
70 yeah. For me, too.
Yeah. Well, even that, I'll take that, too.
I, if it's colder than my age, I've got a problem with it. So that's my deal.
All right. I wasn't far off at 70.
Further east in the lair, the legend is there. How you doing tonight, sir?
Doing great. Thank you, Jeff. just sitting here watching the chat go on. I just read the piece that Alex posted about the end of the upset, which is great thinking and great writing. I enjoy it when Alex chips in his 2 or 3 cents worth. Always good.
Yeah, it is. I can't wait to read it. I'll do my best while we're going through this show to get in there and read some of it. But thank you, Alex, for sharing your thoughts with us once again, sir. We appreciate you very, very much. Bless you, Bob.
Gesundheit.
Horseshoe.
Right, hello to all the folks on the chat line. Thanks for tuning in tonight. Let's get right into it. It is racing season. There is racing to be discussed, and we're going to get into all kinds of racing stuff tonight. And how about that Kyle Busch, man? That overhand right. He's got that thing working for him. What do you think?
Did you see his press conference yesterday?
No, I didn't. I just couldn't believe Logano didn't go down after such a manly strike like that.
No, the thing about Busch, when you didn't see on the television, when he did the press conference yesterday, his right eye is swollen shut and is as black as a Goodyear racing
tire.
Did
that happen while he was on the ground under all the other people?
I don't know when it happened, but he looked like hell, man.
Because that little slap that Logano gave him, I don't think would have blacked anybody's eye.
You could see that coming, though, Tim. You could see the black eye was developing Sunday. Yeah.
But not as bad as what
else. But, well, they pulled a crew member off from with a Pennzoil one, and as he was pulling away, he put a good kick.
That was it.
Don't know to who or to where, but
that was probably it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Good heel kick will black an eye now, I'll tell you. So
is that the voice of experience?
yeah, it will.
From your earlier racing days.
It doesn't have to be racing, man. A heel kick's a heel kick.
True.
Yeah. So chime in on that, fellas. I want to hear what everybody's position is on it. And, Cody, I want to start with you. What happened? Why did it happen? Who's at fault? And what should have been done?
I didn't watch the race, but, you know, definitely
next
time somebody happened. Hold on.
All right.
You know, you see the replay videos and all that kind of stuff. I don't think anybody was at fault. I think that Logano just went deep into three. You know, maybe if it was five to go, he wouldn't have went that deep. Maybe if it was two to go, he wouldn't have went that deep. But the last lap, one turn to go, I'm going to go that deep, and if I just happen to bob a little bit,
especially,
you know,
if it's Kyle Busch, that
I'm sorry, but I really thought that Kyle had calmed down a few years ago after he broke his leg and he won the championship and he had a kid, got a wife, all that kind of stuff. But I mean, this is old Kyle Busch at its finest.
Yeah,
but he was the instigator because he went right up to Logano. I mean, no chance for Logano to even see him coming. Especially when they're both wearing yellow suits, you know, it's hard
to
tell.
Logano saw him coming. He saw him coming, but I can't believe he let him hit him like that. I mean,
he had his posse around him, you know.
Goodness gracious. Those boys need training. If they're going to engage in such activities, they're going to have to stop watching video and have somebody really teach them how to do that stuff.
I'm just surprised that NASCAR has said that they don't want to pursue it, and I think that's because of Monster. I think Monster's saying that's
let him have
not
it.
Saying
have
that's
it.
Not what we live for, but I think Monster is.
If it helps,
say okay with it. But
if it bumps the TV ratings a point, they'll sell more Monster Energy. That's for sure. That's what they're looking for. How about you, Tim?
Monster's,
what do you think?
The only reason they didn't do anything.
Okay, if you go back and watch, and I was watching the whole thing, Brad Keselowski was having problems and was slowing down. He saw Kyle Busch coming up behind him and saw his guy, Joey Logano, down on the inside. So he stayed in the upper lane. Kyle Busch had to make a decision. He came down and bounced off of Logano, bounced off of him. He hit him. They went into turn three, like Cody said, and Logano was pushing it, which I don't blame him. The car slipped a little bit. But at the same time, Kyle was coming down to block him a little bit. So it's probably really nobody's fault, but if you had to get down to the nitty-gritty bolts of the whole thing, it was Kyle Busch caused it, you know, and then for him to pull the stunt he pulled to go over after Logano is just what Cody said. He has regressed to the same demented M&M chewing guy he always has been.
Wow. Okay. Hugh.
I didn't see it that way.
All right, let's hear your side. It's amazing how most people can be watching the same race and see two different things.
Tim, you said that Kyle Busch caused it. Kyle Busch had two choices at that point. He could not go up because Keselowski was out against the wall. he either could hit Kozlowski and cause a horrendous wreck because he was going a lot faster, or he could go down. I didn't see that Kozlowski necessarily caused it, but I didn't see Bush having any choice but to do that or cause a horrific wreck. Yeah, he could have himself spun or spun Logano or both, but I didn't see he had any choice but to do what he did. It wasn't a good choice, but it was, to me, the only choice.
All right, that's that's Hugh's perspective. Bopper, what's yours?
Well, Bush definitely hit. He sideswiped Logano going down the backstretch. Whether he could have avoided the Kozlowski car or not, I don't know. There was the everybody had knew. I mean, the radio chatter had to be going on that Kozlowski's slowing down because a couple of people had already passed him. So I don't think Bush was totally uninformed of that situation. But he did, in my opinion, he slammed Logano. Logano did drive in deep and got into Bush. I don't think that part was intentional, and the body slam might have not been intentional either. I do not like fighting. I mean, I still don't. It don't excite me. It don't make me want to watch the next race. So I'm not a good one to say, yeah, let him go. Yeah.
I'm with you, Bob.
But I do not like that. I would, if I was NASCAR, I'd find the hell out of Kyle Busch. That's just barbaric. That's just my opinion, and I know that's countercurrent, but that looks like a bunch of animalistic rednecks, in my opinion. So
yay, Bopper.
That's me. I don't like fighting. If you can't, you know, it happens. It's racing. If you can't handle it, then you can't handle it. But I think they're going to justify it because they're so desperate for ratings or for anything that moves the needle that they're not saying nothing.
Let's get Jack to chime in before we go. Go ahead, Jack.
I basically agree with what Bobby said and what Tim said, not what Hugh said.
Hugh's a jerk.
But, you know, Kozlowski was really the cause of the whole doggone thing to start with. He even admitted in his interview,
well, yeah,
that he probably caused the whole thing.
But
he did.
It wasn't.
I think other than that, it was just an unintentional.
You had your turn, Hugh. Hold on.
Unintentional circumstances that put them together.
Yeah.
Now, as far as Kyle Busch afterwards, nobody won that deal. Logano didn't win. Kyle didn't win. The only one that won was NASCAR.
Yep.
They got what they wanted.
So let me ask you this. So by not pursuing anything with this, have they, with this group that's out there, have they opened up a can of worms? Will it accelerate?
I don't think they've opened up a can of worms, but Kyle Busch's sponsor may be having something to say with behind closed doors about it, I'm sure.
I agree with
it,
that.
It kind of hurts the image of M&Ms and candy and kids and all that kind of stuff.
They're saying something in open doors.
Oh, are they?
Yeah, if you look on J-Ski, they made a statement that was there today.
And what did it say, Bopper?
It basically said that they were, that behavior did not represent the ideals of Mars, chocolate, America, et cetera, and hopefully that Kyle Busch would, you know, that they were disappointed and he would, you know, learn from this experience. But they also pointed out that they had removed their sponsorship for him a few years ago for the last two races of the year when he intentionally wrecked Ron Hornaday. Remember that?
I had forgotten that. Yeah.
They came back to the surface. So
was that a warning to him?
Well, it might be.
It might be.
Yeah.
You know, you run that risk. You know, M&M's is a kid-friendly.
Yep.
That's their whole mantra, is, you know, that kind of audience. So.
And NASCAR is making a big play for kids in the stands this year.
They sure are. And while we're on the subject of Kyle Busch, does anybody notice the new word that NASCAR has added to their vocabulary after the Xfinity race Saturday?
Which one this time?
Well, Kyle Busch won, and come to find out, his car was just about as illegal as never mind what. It was just so illegal. So they don't take away the win, but his win is now called encumbered.
Yeah, I saw that.
So Kyle Busch has got an encumbered win. and it's like somebody else said on social media, they're not going to take away his wins because they're driving as hard as they can drive to get him above 200 wins so they can say, look, our new generation of race driver has outdone what Richard Petty did.
Didn't somebody else have an encumbered finish last week?
I don't know, but he sure, that's what they're calling it.
I heard that before this week. So what does that mean? Does that have any bearing when it comes chase time or anything?
There was a truck that was encumbered, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was another encumbered finish last week.
I didn't hear it to Kyle. Well, see, the thing about what they're doing here, when you're talking about all three have stages, the truck race, Xfinity, and the Cup. So when you got all these Cup drivers and they're screwing up the poor Xfinity and truck drivers, trying to get points, trying to win points. You know, what is this all about? NASCAR, wake up. That's a totally wasted piece of breath to say that. But what are they doing to the Xfinity regulars and the truck regulars? Obviously, if you look at the stands, they're adding the Cup drivers to the Xfinity race is not putting people in the stands. If anything, it's driving them out.
Yeah, Tim, it's funny you said that because I was thinking exactly the same thing this past week. I think if you finish in the top 20 in the Cup points one year, you should not be able to run in Xfinity race the following year.
Yeah, I totally agree. Race.
Yeah, that'd be a great rule.
They need to make stars out of these guys. They can't do it when somebody's stinking up the show because they've got a multi-million-dollar team and a real experienced driver.
Well, their own advertising is saying this is where the stars come from.
I don't think that their intent by letting them drive in Xfinity Series is to add more crowd to that race. I think it's just to add more branding to those guys because they need them so bad on the Cup side. They don't have fans. They got to have fans somewhere. Okay, so the more branding, the more exposure they can give those guys that run the Cup Series, the more value they have up there.
Well, for me personally, if I have a Saturday off and the Xfinity race is on, if I go through the starting grid and I see four or five Cup guys, it's not even worth my time to watch
right.
it because I know that Kyle Busch is going to win or Keselowski or Logano or Harvick. If those guys are in the race, I honestly just don't even care to watch it.
Right, Cody. That's the same attitude I take about it.
They've got to let these guys in the Xfinity Series and Truck Series become the stars of that series. They got to the inexperienced, less experienced than Cup drivers.
Let's face it. This series, ever since they took it away from the short track venues, has gone down the tubes.
Yep.
Well, I was going to add, I think they need to go back in that. I think they need to take guys from the short tracks that have some fan following and some exposure and try to make them into but you've never heard of these guys and they just show up.
Yep.
I mean, where do they come from?
Well, back Bobby, in the old days, if you want to call it that, back in the 70s, if Bobby Allison showed up in Columbia, South Carolina, that's a whole lot different than Kyle Busch showing up in Dillon Motor Speedway or something today. I mean, the Cup driver today that shows up has got a multi-million-dollar operation behind him. Back then, it was still coming out of a garage and Ewingtown, Alabama, or somewhere like that.
On the back of a flatbed truck.
All right, let's go. Bopper, you're up.
Oh, okay. All right. Cool. I got started on something last week, and we sort of run out of time, so I'm gonna kind of go back to that again.
Yeah, that's cool. Was that Holman Moody
stuff?
Yeah,
I wanted to talk about Holman and Moody because it's one of those things we all, unless you were born under a rock and stayed under one and you was a race fan, a NASCAR fan, you knew about Holman and Moody whether you liked them or not. They were an incredible presence.
I remember one of my good friends got a Holman and Moody tachometer and put it in his car. You know, I mean, just it's Holman and Moody for heaven's sakes.
Yeah, CP.
Yeah,
competition proven was as much of a moniker as HM was. So it was. They were. You know, we all remember them. We lived through that era, and they were. Well, I'll just go through a little bit of their timeline. In 1956, John Holman moved from California to Charlotte to take over the Ford racing effort in NASCAR. He had been working for Bill Stropp and the Western arm of the Ford racing effort. Holman develops special stock car wheels, which became the standard. Peter DiPaolo engineering race cars driven by Joe Etherly, Curtis Turner, Marvin Patch, Bill Amick, Ralph Moody, Fireball Roberts, and others. The main competition was from the Key Kafer Chryslers, and the battles on and off the track were impressive. One particular point of contention was the rumor that the Fords were cheating with locked rear ends. This is in 1956. 1957, NASCAR, the season started with Ford winning race after race, and the other teams began to complain. NASCAR allowed a new Chevrolet engine to even things up, so Ford countered with the introduction of the supercharged 312. The AMA ban on auto racing went into effect in 1957, so Ford and the other manufacturers withdrew sponsorship of racing. Each of the Ford drivers were given a race car, a transporter, and some spare parts. Did y'all know that? Each of the Ford, that was a pretty good gift.
That's a heck of a package. Yeah.
In 1957, there was that, you know, all the factories kind of mutually agreed to, although I don't know that any of them ever did, that publicly they all did.
Yeah, publicly they quit. Privately, it was rumored from day one that they were still in it.
Yeah, some people said Chrysler didn't even bother with that part. They just kept right on going like they were. But that was pretty. Each driver was given a race car, a transporter. What's a transporter in 1957?
It's probably a little...
a box truck and a trailer.
Yeah, a box truck or that little stake truck or whatever they called it. It had the wood stakes around the back of it.
Now, here, John Holman and Ralph Moody put what money they had into buying additional cars and equipment, and Holman and Moody was formed. Lee Holman was given the job of taking inventory of all the spare parts. The Holman and Moody Ford won their first two races in 1957. I read also on another site that Ralph Moody, who come from a midget racing background in the Northeast before World War II, he was you know, when midgets were so big racing every night of the week, he was into that. And after the war was over, he decided to move to Florida so he could race midgets year round. Of course, this would have been the late 40s, and probably when Ralph Moody was making these plans, NASCAR and stock car racing had not really got off. I mean, we know the timeline. It hadn't really got off the ground yet. The midgets were the thing in the late 40s. So, but that put Ralph Moody into the South. In 1958, Holman and Moody entered two 58 Fords in the last two races on the beach at Daytona. The same two cars, one driven by Curtis Turner and the other by Joe Weatherly, raced to first and third in one race and second and fourth in another. Holman Moody began to change from a racing team to a racing factory. In addition to building and racing their own cars, the shop was now building cars and selling them to other teams. By late 1958, Ford's support was slowly returning to racing. This support helped the Holman and Moody team in the construction of 10 1959 Thunderbirds. This was the first time Holman and Moody was able to get bare bodies off the assembly line. The production line was stopped while Holman and Moody got the bare chassis and parts they needed to build the race cars. All unnecessary items in the production automobiles were left off. Curtis Turner wins in a Holman and Moody Ford at Champion Speedway. That would have been at
Fayetteville.
Champions on 3/15 of 1958, Lakewood Speedway on 4/13, and Southern States Fairground at 4/18. That was Piedmont Interstate Fairgrounds.
Southern Spartan. State was in Charlotte.
In 1959, Holman and Moody Power Products Thunderbirds are the talk of Daytona, and we remember what they looked like. Them 59 Thunderbirds, that was what Johnny Beauchamp was driving. When he may or may not have won the race.
There was one in the picture anyway.
Yep, he may or may not have actually won. Johnny Beauchamp in the Holman and Moody car and Lee Petty in an Oldsmobile finish in a virtual dead heat. After 3 days, NASCAR officials decide Petty is the winner by inches. The two cars averaged 135 miles an hour, which made it the fastest stock car race in history. So that's 1959. And through the 60s, the Hoban and Moody thing just, man. And it wasn't just, it was not just in NASCAR.
No, if you were a high school kid and had a Ford, you wanted to go to Holman and Moody, get them to build you an engine.
But it was also drag racing.
It was racing. It was offshore speed boats. Yeah. It was SCCA. It was European Rally. It was IndyCar. It was GT stuff. I mean, they were their record is so across the board. It's incredible. We just really worried about their or was aware of their stock car presence. But they, man, they was everything. 1964, NASCAR Hoban and Moody develops the box steel chassis for NASCAR racing that become the standard for all cars. They also make important developments, including screw jacks and wheel studs. Hoban and Moody is building engines for the Wood Brothers and grinding cams for many other NASCAR teams. Incidentally, the guy we was all trying to remember last week was Lionel Stanley. L.O. Stanley.
L.O. Stanley.
L.O. Yeah. Stanley from Virginia.
Yeah. He built Peanut Turman's motors.
Yep. Yep.
So there's something before you go on about that. If you look at what that said, it was talking about the screw jacks and the lug nuts and all those things. So they basically gave racers parts to replace all those weak points. You know, I mean, that's it's not just motors, but for whatever that was worth.
You know, the more I read about what they were, and you know, remembering all of it, it makes me even more impressed that anybody else won anything in the 60s and the heydays of Hoban and Moody. That was a powerhouse.
Yeah. They had the what apparently was factory backing, and they certainly had the money and the facility to do the work.
Petty had to cheat like hell to outrun them.
I swear he had to. And they had to bring out the Hemi and everything to do that. Now, in 1972, this is the beginning of the course. If y'all will remember just from history, that 1970 was probably the real last high water mark of factory support in NASCAR. In 71, Ford was officially gone again, and Chrysler was down to two cars. Richard Petty and Buddy Baker were factory backed in 71, and Ford was basically out. In 1972, Ralph Moody's stock in Hoban and Moody is bought back by the company, and he goes on to other racing teams. The company's name remains the same in an effort to clear away old race cars. The company has the first of a number of auctions. Hoban and Moody sells all nine GTs, this is those GT40s, some Can-Am cars and some retired stock cars to make room for new projects. NASCAR Hoban and Moody is still building engines for the Wood Brothers and grinding cams for many teams. In 1975, that seems recent, but it's a long time ago if you look at it, if you do the math, John Hoban has a heart attack and dies while testing a new truck intercooler that he hoped to patent. You know, it seems like they were there forever. 1978, Lee Hoban takes over as president of Hoban & Moody and injects new life into the struggling company. His first goal was to get back into racing. So Hoban & Moody begins building race cars again. They built a Mazda, which raced at Le Mans, and also continued with their racing engine programs, including Can-Am and NASCAR engines. In 1982, the Charlotte Airport, which is where they were located, right there on the airport, gave Hoban and Moody notice of their intent to condemn the Hoban Moody building in preparation for a new airport runway. The board of directors chose not to fight the airport and thought that it would be a good time to let any of the stockholders who wanted to cash out do so. The company held an auction to sell off the equipment, and Lee Hoban bought much of it. Hoban and Moody was then going to divide the cash from the building and equipment among the stockholders, and the new company, Hoban Automotive Incorporated, would continue to work the work of building race cars and engines in a new facility. As of 1997, the Charlotte Airport had not condemned the six-acre property, and the two companies, Hoban and Moody and Hoban Automotive, continued to operate out of the same 75,000-square-foot facility. So that was in 1982, which seems real recent, but that was a long time ago, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I read where the GT40 that Ford and to a large extent Holman and Moody created and developed, they won, I guess it was like in 1966 or so, whenever it debuted, they won run 1-2-3 in the 24 hours of Daytona, 1-2-3 in the 12 hours of Sebring, and 1-2-3 at Le Mans in the GT40. And interestingly enough, Lee Holman and Holman Automotive still has the dies and the tooling and everything to build GT40s. And because that is true, and it's the original die, the original stuff that built them to start with, that in vintage racing now, where all that kind of stuff is critical, they can build new GT40s at Holman and Moody, and they're vintage acceptable.
Wow.
They're brand new, but they're made from the very same stuff that the original ones were. So it's a new vintage car. That's kind of cool, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. That's very cool.
That's in vintage racing, that's almost unheard of.
Yep, so you can get a new one that's 1966 vintage, you know, just like they were.
And technology and everything. That's cool.
Yep, so probably, I got that in retrospect thinking about all of this, that probably had the fact that Holman and Moody was in Charlotte in the 50s there at the airport, probably had a lot to do to set Charlotte, the city and the region, on the course that it continued to be on and is on now with all the teams located there.
Absolutely.
And becoming you know, the hub of NASCAR. I think that had probably more than any single thing.
Yep. Because all of the stuff that they produced was available in Charlotte quickly. So why not locate your shop close to the supplier of all of your major parts, especially if you were a Ford team.
And all the talent, all the racing knowledge in those days was even like it is now, it was concentrated in and around Charlotte.
Yep.
Everybody that knew anything was in that area. And I think the fact that Holman and Moody wound up locating there was a lot to do with it. So
that was certainly one of the large factors, because it didn't take much of a stretch for any other hopeful team. Well, we ought to locate in Charlotte. That's where everything else is.
All right. Next up, you good? You good, Bobby? Cody, you going to finish up where you left off 2 weeks ago?
I can, as long as you guys remember what I was talking about.
Give us just a brief synopsis and then get right into it, buddy.
I don't know what brief means.
Please be brief.
All right. So 2 weeks ago, since I had some difficulty last week, I was talking about the Atlanta Motor Speedway and its history since at the time we were going into the Atlanta weekend. So I talked about how it got started in 1958, kind of went bankrupt, and they had to get some new investors. They spent $1.8 million to get the facility ready for 59. They scheduled several different dates in 59 to try and get a race. It rained out each of the time, so on the third attempt, they got a date in 1960 where Pontiac won with Fireball Roberts, number 22. 25,000 people attended. So we'll go on down. A different owner came in the 70s. So where I left off was one particular race in 1978 nearing the end of the season, in closing to Cale Yarborough's third consecutive championship. Richard Petty was in a door-to-door battle with Donnie Allison for the last dozen laps or so. Donnie was flagged the leader at the end of 500 miles. This was before electronic scoring, so Richard knew that he had won, and he thought it was a mix-up. So once he voiced his opinion to the track officials in NASCAR, he was declared the winner. So Allison's car was rolled out of victory lane, and the 43 was in victory lane. Well, soon, Donnie Allison done the same thing as Richard done. So after just finishing his victory lane ceremonies, Petty's car was rolled out of victory lane, and Donnie's was back in. So NASCAR changed their mind yet again. So that was pretty funny. In both 1980 and 83, the track was used in two different movies starring Burt Reynolds, Smoking the Bandit 2 and Stroke Race, which featured some of the greats at the track, including Dale Earnhardt, who was the all-time winner at the track on both configurations with 10 wins. In November of 84, hometown boy Bill Elliott grabbed the pole for the Coca-Cola 500, but lost to Dale Earnhardt in the race. He would have to wait until his breakthrough year in 85, where he earned 2 poles and 2 wins at both races. He had another pole in 86 and his 3rd Atlanta points race in the fall of 87. Bill won the only All-Star event held at the track in May of 86, the only time it was outside of Charlotte. Then present the track, Mike Helton and crew planned it for Mother's Day to honor the racing moms. That was a mistake. With a truckload of roses they ordered for the 25,000 expected ladies, they kept a whole lot of them. Reports say only 18,000 were in attendance, but some say it only looked like 5,000 on the front stretch. And that sounds like today's racing, really. Elliott won yet again at his home track in both races in 92, his first year with legendary owner Junior Johnson. But the last win of the season is what some say the most historic in all of NASCAR history of the modern era. You be the judge of that. It was the Hooters 500. The track was now called Atlanta Motor Speedway, renamed by current owner Bruton Smith, who bought the track in 1990. Every one of the 150,000 tickets were sold out. It was the season finale, and going into the race, there were 5 eligible drivers to win the Winston Cup title. Davey Allison was the points leader entering the race, but about a third of the way into the race, Ernie Irvin spun his number 4 car and hit several cars, including Davey and Richard Petty, who was competing in his last ever NASCAR race. Rookie Jeff Gordon also competed in his first NASCAR race. So now that Davey was out of it, Bill and Alan Kowicki and his Underbird were the favorites to win, but Kyle Petty, Mark Martin, and Harry Gant all still had a mathematical chance of winning the championship. The battle between first and second, the points was so close. At the end, Bill Elliott won the race, leading 102 laps. Alan Kowicki finished 7th and led 103 laps. One more lap than Bill, which gave him the most laps led award, giving him 5 bonus points, earning the Wisconsin native the Winston Cup Championship. And even though Richard Petty was the victim of a wreck early on, his STP crew managed to put in a new radiator and get him out for the last 2 laps of the race to do some parade laps to say his final goodbyes to his fans. In 1994, a new complex of condos reaching 9 stories high was built by Bruton Smith. All this was early preparation for what some say made the track, and what some say what broke the track. In 1997, Bill Elliott was the last driver to drive a stock car on the track, and the first one to get on a bulldozer to tear up the oval track. What was presented to the 1998 season was a D-shaped oval, very similar to both Charlotte and Texas. Many complained about the new shape and size and surface, along with the reversal of the track, but right after the new track was built, turned speeds right along with Daytona and Talladega, with the restrictor plates on at those tracks. Since Atlanta was only a 1-mile track, it did not require plates, or rather a mile and a half. In 2000, Dale Earnhardt won his 10th and final race at the track in one of the closest finishes in NASCAR history against Bobby Labonte. 1 year later, just 3 weeks after the driver of the number 3 was killed, and just the 3rd start of his replacement, Kevin Harvick won in an even closer finish with Jeff Gordon. In fact, since the start of the electronic scoring format, Atlanta has earned several spots on the closest finishes in NASCAR history list. In 2009, the track earned a night race. It took California's place of the Labor Day race. Many fans were angry after the Darlington Southern 500 was taken away from the Labor Day date. This Atlanta deal has helped fans cope with the loss of Darlington. Now, I wrote this several years ago, since Darlington is back on Labor Day. I wrote this in 2011, so a little bit of updating needing to do. But anyway, that was the end of AMS history.
Cody, what was the original people that built Atlanta? Was it American Speedways or something like that?
Well, it was a group of investors. Let me go up to the top here. And planned in 1958 by Walker Jackson, Lloyd Smith, Garland Bagley, and Ralph Ciano and Ike Supporter. So that was the 5
part
guys
of American
that planned
Speedways?
It. No. American not Speedway that I could find
later that, on. They didn't. I don't think they built it, but they acquired it.
But as they were very young,
was that L.G. DeWitt's group or
no? That was a company that came out of nowhere in like 1970. They acquired Atlanta, Michigan, Texas, and then they about lost all of them about as quickly as they.
I didn't realize it was 1970. I thought it was
something like
much
the guy's harder. Name was. I don't know how I remember this, but Larry Lopatin, L-O-P-A-T-I-N.
I think
he was the head honcho of American
Racing. All right.
Coastal Jack Walker. It's time for a Carolina Race Place Historic Race Finish. Take it away, Jack.
Okay, tonight for the Carolina Race Place Historic Race Finish, we are going to Nashville Fairground Speedway. On Sunday, October 3rd, 1971, the 13th annual Southern 300 NASCAR-sanctioned late model sportsman race was held at Nashville Fairground Speedway. In 1970, a major update was made at the track by reconfiguring it to a 5/8 mile paved oval with 36 degree banking. Entries for the 300 came from several drivers running for the NASCAR National Late Model Sportsman Championship. Some of those drivers seeking national points were Red Farmer, Jack Ingram, Ree Greenwell, Harry Gant, Alton Jones, and L.D. Ottinger. Since this was a national championship race, it awarded additional points. To date in 1971, Red Farmer had won national championship races at Greenville, South Carolina, Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and Manassas, Virginia. Missing from an attempt to gain points for a national championship was Sam Summers of Savannah, Georgia. He had cut back on his championship run after being hospitalized for a fight with Roy Tyner at Morven Myrtle Beach Speedway on August 7th. The two-day event started on Saturday with time trials. L.D. Ottinger of Newport, Tennessee, won the pole position. When the 300 took the green flag, Ottinger took the lead, but on lap 10 was passed by Darrell Waltrip. Waltrip clearly had the fastest car on the track and set the pace that was hard for anyone to keep up with. The caution flag flew 13 times that day. On lap 115, the car of Flukie Buford and James Hamm got together on the backstretch, resulting in both cars spinning off the track. Hamm jumped from his car looking to have it out with Buford, but cooled down before blows could be thrown. On lap 142, another wreck happened that involved Walter Wallace and James Clymer and L.D. Ottinger. Luckily, Ottinger had only minor damage and was able to continue. Darrell Waltrip had a comfortable lead, but with 13 laps to go in the race, his car developed transmission problems, which ended his day. Red Farmer, who had been in the top five all day, took over the lead and held on to the checkered flag. It was reported that Darrell Waltrip had tears in his eyes as he could not believe his bad luck. Waltrip led 277 laps of the 300-lap race. Red Farmer won $4,015 for the victory from the $14,330 purse. There were 15,500 fans in attendance. As it turned out, a few weeks later, Red Farmer also would be crowned the 1971 NASCAR National Late Model Sportsman Champion. So here's the way they finished. Fairground Speedway, Nashville, Tennessee. Southern 300 Late Model Sportsman Race, October 3rd, 1971. The winner, Red Farmer, Hueytown, Alabama, driving a Ford, followed by L.D. Ottinger, Newport, Tennessee, in a Chevelle. Jack Ingram, Asheville, North Carolina, Chevelle. Ree Greenwell, Decatur, Alabama, in a Ford. Joe Mangum, Franklin, Tennessee. Harry Gant, Taylorsville, North Carolina. Chester Albright, Cedar Hill, Tennessee. Benny Curley, Hiddenite, North Carolina. Bill Morton, Nashville, Tennessee. Finishing 10th, Darrell Waltrip, Owensboro, Kentucky, in a Chevelle. Joe Westerman, Baltimore, Maryland. Bob Hundley, Nashville, Tennessee. Richard Hesse, Ralph Hodges, Bessemer, Alabama. Robert Reed, Antioch, Tennessee. Leroy Yarborough, Jacksonville, Florida. Jerry Long, Nashville, Tennessee. Johnny Newman, Phil Willis. Felix Treadway from Nashville, Tennessee, finished 20th, followed by Jim Berry, Nashville, Tennessee. Ronnie Blassingham, Lawrenceburg, Tennessee, Wayne Carden, Nashville, Tennessee, Henry Brooks, McCall, Alabama, Walter Wallace, Nashville, Tennessee, Don Anthony, Birmingham, Alabama, Buddy Bird, James Clymer, Murfreesboro, Tennessee, Carl Lane, Nashville, Tennessee, finishing 30th, Fluky Buford, Thompson Station, Tennessee, James Hamm, Nashville, Tennessee, Alton Jones, Pleasant Grove, Alabama, Gary Cook, Nashville, Tennessee, Gene Payne, Owensboro, Kentucky, and the 35th and final car, Charlie Brinkley, Hendersonville, North Carolina.
Good stuff, man. Good stuff. All right, Tim, take it away, Legendorial.
Part of the Legendorial for tonight is entitled Old Man Hair. For those of you who may remember, I was not here last Tuesday because my youngest grandson was playing in his school's spring band concert. Although I learned of it at the last minute, I was determined to be there as I try to support my grandsons in everything they do. When I go to Sam's soccer games, he is the captain and leading scorer of his high school team in his senior year. I wear the trademark cowboy hat. For the band concert, it was dress slacks and dress shirt, but no cowboy hat. By the time I got to the school, the auditorium was packed. As I tried to find a seat, I ended up on the very front row, which suited me fine, and my seatmate to my right was 9 years old and a very talkative young lady. She had a vocabulary DW would envy, and between performances, she was talking my ears off. Then a band director from another school came to the podium. He was huge with all silver hair, and lots of it. My seatmate drew back in her seat as afraid, and I asked her what was wrong. She said, quoting now, "He has old man hair, and I'm afraid of that." I sort of laughed to myself as to not embarrass the child, but I pointed out that I, too, had old man hair, although quite a bit less than did the band director. She said she noticed that I had a little bit of old man hair, but that I was nice and she wasn't afraid of me. That conversation with my new 9-year-old friend, BJ, got me to thinking about all the gray in my hair and the ever-thinning top of my head. While once I may have bemoaned the fact of growing old and still joke about that point endlessly, it really doesn't bother me anymore outside the pains from spending too much time doing yard work. Well, let me tell you why. Thanks to my old man hair, I was able to watch the golden age of NASCAR pass before my very eyes. I watched the Hudson Hornets race. I saw the Flock Brothers, Fireball, Little Joe, Herb Thomas, and many, many more, some of whose names appear in racing records while others are left to disappear as if never existing in the sport. I saw convertibles race at Darlington, along with a few other tracks. But seeing that 1957 Breville 300 with a 3-abreast start of convertibles lives in my mind as if watching the replay on my monitor screen right now. I was able to witness the very first World 600 in June of 1961 as I stood next to the fence in turn 4 and watched the asphalt fly up from the track as if it were bullfrogs jumping off lily pads. I witnessed firsthand the first race of the man who would become known as the King, and a year later watched that same young man win his very first race. I watched the only stock car race ever run on a road course in Augusta, Georgia, which was both exciting and memorable for a number of reasons. I watched the sport grow from the short tracks to the super speedways and grow across the country. I saw firsthand R.J. Reynolds through its Winston brand paint the racing world red and white, and winning the Winston Cup was the goal of every driver on the track. I saw men die in races I attended, the 1957 Southern 500, the 1959 Southern 500, and the 1964 World 600 flash before me as severe lightning in a South Carolina summer thunderstorm. I have seen men and women walk away from crashes that should have taken their lives. And on a February Sunday afternoon in 2001, albeit watching on television, I saw a less than spectacular accident take the life of one of the sport's biggest stars. All those memories and many, many, many more are stored underneath this old man here. I'm glad I have those memories as I watch rule after rule being made by the sanctioning body, as if those rules are intended to be nails in the coffin of NASCAR racing. Stages are okay with me. Playoffs and racing are not. The 5-minute repair clock is an abomination to the very reason we have the honor of claiming Benny Parsons as a Winston Cup champion. And without detailed researching, how many others claimed a championship by being able to repair and return to the race? If I were computer savvy enough, I would run the 1992 stats of Alan Kowicki and Bill Elliott to see what difference one finishing position may have made in one race where one or the other repaired the car to finish one or two positions higher than they would have finished had they been required to park it. Today, Sunday, I read in the newspaper here an article by George Diaz, who covers NASCAR for the Orlando Sentinel. Seems NASCAR wants to rule out the sound of race cars to a much softer sound. Part of the sport to me, along with the color, has always been the sound of the cars, and that includes cars idling in the pits or at full speed on the track. To even think about such action is, in my opinion, ludicrous. To take away even a decibel of sound of the sport is a travesty to good sense. The sport has gone downhill over the past several years, and while many of us like to blame a certain individual for that decline, it is apparently more to it than that. Surely, no one man could have a mind so inept as to drastically change everything that made the sport exciting and worth watching, now a pitiful display of overpaid drivers and cars, no way appearing stock, and on tracks that can't begin to compare to North Wilkesboro or Rockingham. Chicagoland, Kansas come to mind, followed not far behind by Texas. So, now I suppose I'll go comb old man hair and watch the race from Las Vegas. My favorite memory of Las Vegas is Ann Margaret and Elvis in Viva Las Vegas, along with the invention of the Polish victory lap. I want to throw out a special thank you to my new friend BJ for enlightening me to what a blessing having old man hair truly is. Thank you, Jeff, and back to you.
All right, you old man, you with old man hair. That's good.
I got it.
Yeah, Tim, that was cool.
All right.
Thank BJ for that.
It's now time for Hugh's views on the news.
I don't have a lot tonight, folks.
All right, next.
But Cody brought up the 92 Atlanta race, which was Petty's last race, and Tim alluded to it. I was there for that race. It was one of the first races that the company that I worked for did to pre-race and post-race. So I was there for Richard Petty's last race and the crash that took him out, and his crew managed to put him back on the track. Nobody had ever heard of Jeff Gordon. He hardly made a blip. But I remember vividly the win that Kowicki had and how much the fans got into that. For whatever he may have been or not been, the fans were really behind Alan Kowicki. He was a very likable, very personable guy, and it was, to my mind, one of the most memorable championship wins that I've ever witnessed. But it was, to me, one of the most historic races that I've ever had the privilege to attend. Did any of the rest of you guys go?
I was there with Ronald Reagan.
You were?
Yep.
that was Dayton.
That was when I was with the Secret Service. See, that's secret. You don't know about things like that.
That's right, yeah.
That's why they call it secret.
That's right.
Secret. Yeah, there you go.
Now, I had been watching Jeff Gordon on Thursday Night Thunder, and I watched that Atlanta race in particular to keep up with him. I remember at one point he got up to sixth place.
Yeah, you knew Gordon was going to be a star of some sort. You just didn't know how much of a star, but a star.
Who could have imagined how much of a star? Sure enough.
Yeah, he moved the needle. No doubt.
He really did. He moved Earnhardt's needle. That was for sure. the word was that they told him, says, you go out there and get behind that number three and watch what he does and copy him. And apparently he took them seriously, because every time you looked, the 24 car was right on the back bumper of the three. So much so that it sort of unnerved Earnhardt to have this kid that nobody knew, not only out there on the track as a rookie, but following along second to him, ahead of everybody else out there on the track, but those two. I thought it was really comical to watch. And, of course, Earnhardt had some choice words about it along. To be such a really, in real life, nice guy, he certainly did have a blustery persona.
So to correct your historical error, Reagan was at this race. He gave the command to start the engines.
At Atlanta?
I was there holding the mic for him.
You were?
Yep.
Gentlemen, start your motors.
Yep. Boys, start them engines. It's time to go racing, boys.
Time to go racing.
Boogity, 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 boogity.
That's where Darrell Waltrip got the slogan.
Yeah. That's funny. I don't care who you are. That right there is funny. All right, boys, that's been good. We got through that and just lickety-split. Got everybody in. I didn't miss anybody, did I?
Nope.
Everybody got in good. That's good. Everybody get everything they wanted to say out?
Yep.
Good? All right. Never mind. Thanks to all of you for tuning in, letting us be a part of your Tuesday night. I'd like to say thanks to Sadie for not barking during the show. That was good. She does have some pretty bad gas, though, I got to tell you. I got to take her out of here. But anyway.
I'm glad she's in the control room with you.
Yeah, she is. She's in here. For sure. Thanks to all you guys for putting the show together and contributing. Man, I love doing this with you. You guys are awesome, and I always look forward to it. And I just want to keep telling you how much I appreciate you. Say a prayer for our buddy Jimmy Johnson, whose surgery was postponed today because he has an infection. He's going to go home, rest a bit, and then go back and get it on with his heart surgery and such. So keep him in your prayers. We love old JJ. Well, we want to say a special thanks to the men and women that serve our military. Thank you for doing what you do so that we can do this. And to each and every one of you, good night and God bless.
Good night, guys.
Good night.
Racing through history.